Hello there, welcome to this very special 50th episode of Double Jeopardy with me, Ken McDonald.
And with me, Tim Owen.
And we're delighted that for our 50th episode, we should have a particularly brilliant guest, and we're honoured and privileged to be joined today by Professor Joe Phoenix. Joe has lectured in criminology in the universities of Middlesex, Bath, Durham. She was head of the Department of Law at Leicester, and after this, she left Leicester for what she described as her dream job as a professor of criminology at the Open University. Her research has focused on sex, gender studies, prostitution policy, women in prison, and it's fair to say, I think, that she approaches her work from what some people describe as a gender-critical perspective, although I know she's not herself too keen on that description, which is to say that she believes that sex is biological, immutable, not something which is assigned at birth, and she believes that women's sex best rights are important and need to be protected. In 2021, along with Professor Rosa Friedman, Jo was due to speak on the topic of trans rights in prisons at the University of Essex. The seminar was cancelled after activists threatened to block the entrance to cause problems and implied in some cases that violence might ensue. I want to quote from a flyer that was circulated on the university campus at that time. It will lose us our clean rating, but I think it's worth reading, and I hope you're not offended by the language. This showed a cartoon character pointing a gun at the viewer with the words, "Shut the fuck up, turf. Joe Phoenix is a transphobe who should not be invited to this university. You can't call yourself a feminist if you don't respect trans women!" Exclamation mark. Delegitimizing trans people is part of a misogynist, colonialist, and violent ideology. The author of these words doesn't seem to have been troubled by the irony of citing a violent ideology on a poster which features a cartoon of someone pointing a gun at the viewer. Later, the sociology department in Essex voted to ban Joe Phoenix from the university permanently. Not surprisingly, there was a fury about this, and the vice-chancellor apologised to Joe Phoenix, but his apology was perhaps somewhat undermined by the fact that he then immediately apologised to those trans and non-binary people who he thought may have been offended by his apology to Joe. You really couldn't make it up. In June of 2021, Joe set up the Gender Critical Research Network, and her problems at the Open University really started. After a campaign of intimidation, lies, and harassment by some of her colleagues, which the university itself did little or nothing to protect her from, she felt forced to leave and accepted an invitation to set up a Department of Criminology at the University of Reading, where she now works. It seems the University of Reading has a better understanding of what a university is than the Open University. And the Open University and some of its members were publicly disgraced earlier this year by an excoriating judgment in an employment tribunal case brought by Joe, in which it found that she'd been constructively dismissed by the university and her rights abused. Much of the evidence of her former colleagues was criticised, and on occasions it was disbelieved, and an overwhelming impression was created of an institution which had allowed a contested ideology, gender identity theory, special privileges to shut down academic debate, to intimidate and silence his opponents, and to debase intellectual inquiry on pain of cancellation. Joe, as I've said, we're honoured and privileged to have you with us here today. Welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Thank you very much. It is my delight to be here.
Yes. Hi, Joe. Great to meet you.
So, Joe, we normally start by asking our guests a little bit about their backgrounds and what brought them to their career. Of course, you're not a lawyer, you're a criminologist, and I know Tim wants to discuss the differences between that at some stage, and that's indeed a very interesting topic. But you have, as I've said to a number of our guests in the past, quite an unusual background and quite an unusual route into your discipline. I mean, what brought you to criminology?
I came into it by accident, quite literally by accident. I'm a sociologist. I came to university late. I'd left school when I was 15 years old. I'd had a bit of trouble in Texas. I'd witnessed quite a bit of violence in Texas, specifically male violence, and I had been the victim of it myself. I end up in this country at the age of 18 with literally no academic qualifications, but the people that I was staying with, an aunt and uncle, encouraged me to get A-levels. I did a sociology A-level because I didn't know anything about England. I then found myself at Bristol University in 1985 doing a sociology degree. I loved it. I went to do a social policy and gender master's. That's back when gender meant feminism and women. I loved that. But on that course, I read a book called Women's Imprisonment by an academic called Pat Carlin. And for me, it was like the lights suddenly went on. And I fell in love with a topic I soon found out was called criminology.
While we're on the subject, as Ken said, I wanted to raise this question of the difference between criminology and law, because I think you think that maybe the relationship between criminologists and lawyers is, I don't know what you think. You can tell us what you think. I mean, I'll ask you to give your definition. If you go to Wikipedia, it says criminology is the interdisciplinary study of crime and deviant behavior. Criminology is a multidisciplinary field in both the behavioral and social sciences, which draws primarily upon the research of sociologists, political scientists, economists, legal sociologists, psychologists, philosophers, psychiatrists, social workers, biologists, social anthropologists, scholars of law and jurisprudence, as well as the processes that define the administration of justice and the criminal justice system.
Now, what about dentists?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what Wikipedia says. What do you reckon?
I think I can give you a slightly easier definition. It is a rendezvous point. There are a number of different disciplines that contribute. However, we can cut through all of that and say criminology is about studying rulemaking, rule breaking, and rule enforcement, and the different meanings for crime and justice in a society at any one given time. That's a bit easier, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot easier, and it's entirely understandable. I mean, I noticed when I was working in a university for some years that some legal academics are a bit snooty about criminologists, and maybe that's dying out. But I think there still is a bit of snootiness, isn't there, as to whether criminology is a real discipline or whether it's just in fact some sort of slightly bastardized aspect of public policy.
Yeah, and no, that's still there. There are some interesting paradigmatic differences in teaching law students, as I am now in the School of Law. And just to go back and correct, I was in the Department of Criminology at Leicester, not the law department.
Sorry, all right. Okay.
But teaching law students now, the fascinating thing is that I have to teach them how to think, because the law training that they've had teaches them how to read information, comprehend it, and regurgitate it. However, I then have to get them understanding that there is no fact out there. They have to learn how different facts are interpreted and then how to think beyond those things. So I would say to you that actually it's not that lawyers are snooty about criminologists. I think a few of us criminologists are maybe a little snooty about law.
Well, I could say that having listened to that, you sound a bit more like an academic than many of your opponents. Well, I thought it'd be useful to Joe to turn to the aspects of the discipline of criminology that you chose to focus on. As I've already said, it was sex, gender studies, prostitution policy, women in prison, and I'm interested in why you chose those aspects and how it was that you began to view them from what we can loosely describe as a gender critical perspective. And that may be two questions in one, but can we start with your choice of the specialities?
Yeah, I mean, I came into this through being a bit of a feminist activist in the 80s, quite frankly. And, you know, throughout even my undergraduate degree and the master's, I just kind of pursued all the stuff that had to do with women, you know, just for personal interest. But also because after I left Texas, I became very aware that women had a very different place in society than men did. Now, in terms of the topics that I've picked, prostitution was interesting to me because it's actually the meeting point, if you like, between class divisions, as well as, you know, justice, questions of justice, particularly for the women who can be both victims and offenders. And, you know, this whole thing about how did I get into gender critical, I don't know that I can actually put a date on it. But what I can say to you is that my domain assumption, if you like, as an academic, is that women's access to justice, either as victims or as offenders, is unequal simply because of the fact that we live in unequal societies that are structured by sex inequalities, if you like. And, you know, that everything else is shaped from that. So it's kind of like partly my own political passions, but it's also deep core value of mine that women do have a different experience in this world than men.
Yeah. In your witness statement, which you lodged in support of your discrimination claim against the Open University, you said that in the 80s you were part of the radical feminist movement and so on. But I think you said also you then left that at the Blue Gate at Greenham Common. Is that right? How did that happen?
Well, I wasn't just part of the radical feminist scene. I was also part of the radical lesbian separatist feminist scene. And so, you know, my early 20s was marked by, you know, campaigns to get men out of everything, to live a life without men, which, you know, is fine if you're in your 20s and you're a hot-headed lesbian. And I was a hot-headed lesbian. But the problem is that those politics block off certain ways of thinking and certain questions. And one of the reasons I left those politics at the gate of Greenham, or Blue Gate at Greenham, was because I started studying prostitution. If you're a radical feminist, there's usually the political position that all prostitution is always bad, it's always male violence. However, the second you start talking to women who are in prostitution, you begin to recognize that although they are victimized, they may not be victims and nothing more, if you like. So it was my desire to kind of move beyond the constraints of the politics. Oh, how ironic. My desire to move beyond the constraints of the politics that meant that I left those behind and became a little bit more nuanced.
When did you obviously developed this, as I say, we're using a shorthand here, gender critical view of the world and of your discipline. I mean, when did you first begin to notice serious pushback on this? Because, I mean, 10 or 15 years ago, to say sex is real, it's not simply something that is assigned at birth, would have been an entirely uncontroversial statement. Now it's regarded by many people as an expression of really grotesque bigotry. So when did you first notice pushback against what seems to be pretty basic science?
I can't put a date on it, but I can tell you exactly where I was. It's like one of those moments when the lights go on. I was sitting in the car park of Sainsbury's in Leicester, having been...
That's very specific.
Yeah. Right over King Richard's grave, probably.
Probably. Well, no, slightly outside. But I was being interviewed by a local journalist who had called me on my mobile and asked me about my opinion as to whether, I can't remember the person's name, it was a transgender prisoner in a male prison who had committed suicide, and what my views were as to whether that person should have been in a female prison. And I found myself saying, of course not. And then when I recounted this to some of my colleagues at the Open University, the look I had was like, I'd just said something terrible.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was struck by your description of why you joined the OU, and you described it, I think, as Ken said in the introduction, as the dream job, and that you were joining a department with lots of colleagues who you had known for years, and people who were then to feature as giving evidence for the OU against you in your claim. And clearly, and I think that was in 2016 when you joined the OU. So clearly, at that stage, in terms of the evolution of this controversy, if that's the right word to describe it, about gender critical versus trans rights self-identification debate, clearly this was not something that concerned you or potentially alarmed you about joining the OU and that group of colleagues back in 2016.
No, it absolutely didn't. And I mean, when I describe it as my dream job, I'm not being sentimental. It literally was. I kept saying to my partner at the time, in the years previously, there were only two places I would leave Leicester for. One was the OU, one was Bristol, because I have a love of Bristol as a city. And so, you know, when the opportunity came up, that was great. But the first time I noticed it actually in the department was over the GRC consultation. So the GRC consultation was a government consultation about whether or not self-identification should or ought to be brought in for trans-identifying people. What happened was one of my colleagues sent an email around to the whole department Appended to that email was what I can say now. I couldn't say it in the hearing. I can say now was what I thought was a bunch of screed against particular people, gender-critical people. And she was asked, or they were asking for a departmental response saying that self-identification was the way forward. What they had appended, it was Lee Downs. What Lee Downs had appended was a document which said any contest against self-identification was ipso facto transphobic, that there were feminists going around saying they were feminists, but they weren't. They were actually people supported by the far right in America. I mean, it was astonishing.
I mean, this is the whole point, isn't it? It's not just a position that self-identification is the right way forward. It's a position that anyone who opposes that is a bigot.
Quite.
On par with a racist or an anti-Semite or a Holocaust denier. And Stonewall was explicit in making these sorts of comparisons. One of the things that seems to me in the university context to be most disturbing about this, that debate was impossible because if you wanted to debate, you were ipso facto a fascist. Let's just move to Essex and what happened at Essex, because it became a bit of a cause célèbre, on the one hand for transgender activists and on the other for those who believed that free speech in universities was seriously under threat as a result of the way this ideology was being proposed and promulgated. And you were due to speak, I think, along with Rosa Friedman, at a fairly innocuous sounding seminar on the question of trans rights, but a group of people at the university, not just students, also some academics, decided they knew who you were before you arrived.
I mean, it was the most extraordinary thing. It would talk about, you know, baptism by bloody fire. I'd had all sorts of stuff happening in the department. There'd been a cancelled conference, various things had happened, but to me, it was just happening within my department, if you follow what I mean. I didn't realize just how far the foot soldiers of Stonewall had got in universities. So, yeah, Rosa and I were speaking at different events. She was in January. I was in the December. I was due to speak about, you know, the challenges that we see with regards to self-identification in prisons. I thought it was nothing terribly controversial, but I had warned the person who invited me that there may be some controversy, but that's all I thought. And then on the day that I was due to drive down to Essex, I get this message from Nigel South, who was one of the people who had invited me, saying that students were threatening to protest. And to me, as those events unfolded over the next week, the cancellation, or actually it was originally a postponement of the seminar because they couldn't guarantee my safety, and then the eventual blacklisting by the Department of Sociology, I thought, how on earth have we got here? And to me, it was a very, very bleak moment in my academic career, because these things, because you've been cancelled, you become a risky speaker. So it makes it much more difficult for universities to invite you.
And I just want to make 2 points about this. First of all, Rosa Friedman, I think, was due to speak on some topic related to the Holocaust. Rosa, of course, is a Jewish academic, and she was felt to be unsuitable to speak on that topic because of her gender critical views, which is the most extraordinary abuse of any normal concept of free expression and academic freedom. But secondly, the fact that you were banned from the university by a vote of academics in the sociology department is an utter disgrace.
Well, and I just want to add a little bit more color to that. It wasn't that I was just banned, which is an utter disgrace, as you say, but I was banned after they asked me to provide my slides and talk so that they could politically vet me. Now, you know, in my mind, that goes against literally every single professional ethic that we have as an academic. And it wasn't the students who did that. It was academics who did that.
That is the aspect of this whole thing. I mean, there are many things about it which are shocking. But That's the thing that strikes me, is that in an institution that's supposed to be devoted to learning and promoting academic freedom, this degree of bigotry and cancellation exists. And in your witness statement, you, in the section of your witness statement, you describe your beliefs, and you say your belief in the immutability and importance of biological sex comes from the fact that being female is core to who I am and to my life experience. It's also central to my academic work as a sociologist and a criminologist. And then you describe the really terribly difficult childhood that you have, culminating in Texas in you being homeless at the age of, I think, 15, and after being a victim of violence and witnessing a horrific school shooting when you were very young. And then you go on to describe also, in terms of your research, how biological sex is absolutely key to understanding prostitution, prostitution policy reform, child sexual exploitation, and the social regulation of sexual activity. So you're describing there both your personal experience that's led you to the beliefs you have, as well as the more academic aspect to it. And I'm just curious, I mean, at any point in this terrible saga, which sort of began in about 2018 and then culminated in you being forced out, I mean, did you ever have what could be described as a normal, serious, civilized discussion with any of these colleagues who emerged so terribly from this judgment?
No. I mean, you know, I'd like to say more than that, but no. You know, the experience, it's very difficult to describe to people what an everyday experience feels like when you are being silenced, because, of course, you can't put your finger on it and go, look, that's when they said, although I can, because I did get told I wasn't allowed to talk about it. But you go into a room, people will look at you with a smile on their face. They'll talk about their research, everybody else's research. And there's no way that you can get into that conversation, because the second you do, you can just feel the chill hit the room. And then, of course, you know, by the time it got to the terribleness, 2019, after I got cancelled at Essex, it was around that time period that that cold chill turned into direct commands. And so it was around that time period that I got told I couldn't talk about being cancelled, right? Which, you know, I mean, how extraordinary is that?
Sorry, what do you mean when you say you were told you couldn't talk about being cancelled? Do you mean the Open University?
My head of department told me that I couldn't talk about what happened to me at Essex because it was too challenging for my departmental colleagues. And in the same conversation, told me that I couldn't talk about my research.
Jesus Christ.
So you got no, I mean, far from getting any support as a result of that, it seemed to kick off what the Employment Tribunal later found, as I've already said, was a campaign of lies, bullying and harassment against you. I mean, it really kicked off, I think, after in June 21, you set up the Gender Critical Research Network, and some very well-known feminist scholars, Kathleen Stock, Selena Todd, joined in that enterprise. It was a group of extremely distinguished academics coming together to share ideas, to share research, to encourage each other. And you were treated like pariahs.
Yeah. 100%. So can I just say why I thought and why I know that the original vision of the OUGCRN was a great one? All of us in our different fields, Kathleen, Selena, everybody, Rosa, John, everyone who was a part of that had experienced some type of harassment or bullying. And it means that for us as academics, because you know you're going to get attacked for what you say, the robustness of what you say is of a different order of magnitude than people who just throw mud at you.
Let me just put to you, I suppose, try and put to you what I guess the argument from the other side would be. And it's sort of referred to in the judgment about this concept of harm. You know, what you're saying, the advancement of the views you hold is causing me harm. And the judgment dismisses that largely in the context of your expression of your beliefs, of, for want of a better word, gender critical perspective and the importance of biological sex. I say, no, it may be offences caused, somebody is offended by what you say, but they're not actually harmed. But I suppose the argument would be, much as you describe how your childhood experiences influenced in part the beliefs you hold. I suppose the argument might be, well, if I am a trans woman, or if I'm defining myself as non-binary, that I feel under threat in a society which is hostile to my existence or the way I define myself. And therefore, you're not entitled to express your beliefs, which cause me to feel, I don't know, harmed, isolated. I mean, what's your response to that?
I think, fine, people can think what they want. It's altogether different when you bring that into a university where the core function is debate. And I just want to go back to something else, right? This isn't the first time that criminology as a discipline has had to deal with stuff like this. There was a very, very famous issue back in the 1980s called the Black criminality debate. And there were various people who put forward the idea that Black people, because there were more Black people in the criminal justice system, it means that Black people are more criminal, right? I don't want to say reprehensible views. I think they're short-sighted. However, there was pushback in contemporary terms to those from two different constituencies, if you like. One said, okay, well, let's look at this supposed problem and try and explain it. The other one was, well, that's all just ideological, you know, bullshit, if you pardon my language. It's a smoke and mirrors game. It's because of this, that, the other. The point that I'm making here is that even at that point, that was 1986, we were talking about this stuff. People got very, very impassioned. People also got quite offended by other people's views. And I would be offended by some of the views put forward at that point. I was offended. But to now, 40 years later, say offense is now harm. That's altogether different. Now, what I constantly said to the OU people was, where's the evidence? Show me the evidence of harm. If harm is simply, I don't like what you're saying, then that's not harm.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it almost always is. And this is, I think, a big difference and part of what's been happening, I think, since around sort of 2014, 2015. I mean, academics famously get angry with each other. I mean, they write the most unpleasant, nasty reviews of each other's work. I mean, it's the tyranny of small difference. It can be a hellish environment. I mean, sitting in a senior common room. But this is new. The idea that we are not going to have a discussion here because what you were wanting to say is completely impermissible because it undermines my self-belief about who I am. That's what's new. And that's what's been strongly advanced by Stonewall and what they advanced through their so-called no debate policy. And it's a trump card which shuts down any discussion that anybody says impacts on their identity. And it's in the context of a university is just utterly hopeless. You can't have a university functioning according to those rules, which I think is why it's so shocking that your colleagues at the Open University, or so many of them, seem to have completely misunderstood this. They were working inside a sort of intellectual closed shop with very strict rules about what could be said and what couldn't be said. And so they were missing half the evidence in all of their discussions.
Yeah. Well, they were encouraged not to think. Yeah. I mean, I have very particular views, and it will come as no surprise to you that I am highly critical of Stonewall. If Stonewall hadn't had the entree that it had into our universities, at least over this issue, we would not be facing this problem. And I've often referred to several of my colleagues and many EDI people in universities as the ideological foot soldiers for Stonewall. And they are,
Is that through the Stonewall diversity
champion scheme? The champion scheme.
Not just that, Stonewall sold all sorts of little kite marks, if you know what I mean. That was just one of them. But Stonewall also has a hand in writing the actual policies. So to me, when I looked at the Stonewall guidance that was given to the Open University, and it said, basically it was putting forward a self-identification policy, and that any questioning of that was anti-trans. At that point, I knew we were in trouble.
Yeah, they have a league table. They tell you what you have to do to advance on the league table. They then mark your homework, and you pay them for the privilege. So unless you do what they say you need to do, you don't advance up the table. I mean, the whole thing looks very much like a racket, frankly, and its effects on universities has been really, really serious.
Deadly.
But can we just move to what it was? I mean, you, as you said, this was your dream job. You, in one sense, took a demotion. You'd been head of department. You took a cut in salary because you wanted to be associated with an institution that was involved in access, in outreach, in adult education, all the things that the OU stands for. What was it that finally precipitated your decision that you had to leave, which the employment tribunal characterized as unmistakable constructive dismissal?
It was a build-up. It was the university's lack of care about me and the other people in the OUGCRN. It culminated, I mean, their failure, abject failure to protect any of us, but me particularly. But it culminated in a statement that the Open University put out by the Vice Chancellor on something like November the 10th. And that statement continued the thing that I had been hearing all along. And that was not so much harm on both sides, but an acknowledgement that the OUGCRN had caused harm to the trans and non-binary community. And to me, it was just like, okay, so how many months later? That was like 4 or 5 months after I'd already submitted a grievance and been told constantly that the reaction of my colleagues was, that their bullying and harassment was protected by academic freedom.
To be clear, your colleagues were trying to force the closure of the Gender Critical Research Network on the grounds that it was a bigoted organization, not truly academic, and damaged the reputation of the OU. That was their position.
Yeah, that was their position. And, you know, what they kept saying is, oh, we're not trying to stop Jo doing her work, but we don't want the OUGCRN associated with the Open University. So we call on the university to shut it down and we'll create boycotts until it does.
And the Vice Chancellor, in essence, put out a public statement acknowledging his view that the Gender Critical Research Network was causing harm to trans and non-binary people, although there never seemed to be any evidence of any actual harm.
No. And in fact, you know, it was a little bit more, I'm going to say the word Weasley here.
Feel free.
It was a little bit more Weasley than that, because in fact, what the statements, and it wasn't just one, it was several statements said, wasn't so much we acknowledge the harm. It was we acknowledge that that community says that they have been harmed, at the same time as saying, as never saying, gender critical beliefs are protected. And that asking for a pile on, that the open letters, the petitions, the calls for discrimination, et cetera, that those are actually creating a hostile environment or in fact harming us, even though they had my medical notes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, what are the extraordinary things about the employment tribunal ruling in your case is that at the beginning, in what is a really incredibly detailed, carefully reasoned ruling.
Excellent judgment.
It's really worth reading if you want to appreciate quite how shocking the behavior of the OU was. But I mean, it begins, claimant's witnesses, Professor Joanna Phoenix and one other person, and then the respondent's witnesses, in other words, the OU University, there's about 25 of them. So all of these people were called by the OU, and with almost no exception, the tribunal prefers your evidence to any of the witnesses from the OU on any issue, a disputed issue of fact, which is a pretty extraordinary outcome if you think about it. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you is this. So we know from Kathleen Stock, her experience at Sussex, we know from the Rheindorf report and your own experience about Essex University, and now we know about the Open University. You're currently at Reading, who seem to have welcomed you immediately after you leave the OU. I suppose my real question is this: to what extent are Essex, the OU, and Sussex exceptions to this, as opposed to the norm in your particular area of study on this issue? In other words, what is the state of academic freedom, as far as you're concerned, in your field of study?
In grave health. Mm. In grave health. I think that Reading is the exception. And I think it's the exception for a particular reason. And other universities would do well to pay attention to what happens here. There is an exceedingly strong leadership from the Vice Chancellor that draws a line between.
He's a very good vice chancellor.
He's excellent. I've worked for a lot of vice chancellors. He's excellent. He draws a very distinct line between debate and offense. He also supports protest as long as it's lawful. And he puts in place, you know, the university puts in place security measures to make sure that everything goes well. You know, and when I say security measures, I don't just mean, you know, security officers. I mean, they make sure that they're doing due diligence about monitoring social media, about looking at to see if there are any kind of like provocateurs outside who might bring trouble to the university. So, you know, he takes his responsibility. The university takes it very seriously here. Sadly, most other universities don't. But I can also say it's not just like the Open University in Essex. There was colossal failures of leadership. And, you know, I can't say so much about Sussex. One can presume that that was the case. You know, but people are afraid to enter the debate.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that fear that drives the failures, I think.
It's the chilling effect. Yeah.
I think that's a really key point, actually. I mean, I remember having experience at my university of talking to very junior academics who didn't have tenure and them lowering their voices at certain points when they were talking to me and looking over their shoulders. That was something I think I've said before on the podcast, started around 2014, 2015. It's very, very noticeable that particularly in certain departments, people were reluctant to express particular views. I mean, David Bell at Reading is a former permanent secretary at the education department. He's very good on all this kind of stuff. It is really a question of leadership. Some universities are well led on these issues. Some have just completely sold the past. I mean, I think one of the most shocking things about your case is that so much of this behavior happened after the courts had declared, without any possible mistake about their declaration, that gender critical beliefs are protected beliefs worthy of respect in a democratic society. And it's in the face of that court declaration that these people continue to debate you and to abuse you and to harass you. And that's pretty shocking, particularly when some of the people doing that were themselves law academics. I mean, it's a bit of a contradiction in their calling, I'd have thought.
Yeah, well, you know, in my view, what drives all of this is the arrogance of the righteous.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the reaction been to the judgment? What did the OU say? Are they appealing? Are they?
No, they're not. They're not appealing.
No, they're not appealing. Here's a mark of Ben Cooper in the summation characterized the management at all levels of the Open University as suffering from institutional cowardice. But you can see that kind of mismanagement, misstepping, cowardly footing right the way through to after the judgment came out. So when the judgment comes out, the OU issue a statement within, you know, an hour or so that says that they're going to consider their position. They're concerned about my welfare and the welfare of the 18 witnesses who had just been proven to be unlawful, acting unlawfully. And then only four days later, did they issue a statement saying that they weren't going to appeal and that they apologized to me.
They did apologize.
But, you know, I've been apologized to before. You know?
Yeah, if you're apologizing to someone who's been wronged, it does slightly militate against the effectiveness of that apology if you also then apologize to the people who've done the wronging.
Yeah.
Which seems to be rather a pattern here.
Yeah. Because, of course, there's a finding that not only were you discriminated against, but you were also victimized.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the whole thing is just extraordinary to me. I mean, there's a whole nother question that you could ask me. And that was like, what did I think would happen as we went into the hearing? And what are my reflections now? And
tell us.
Yeah, please tell us.
So I kind of assumed that the stuff that happened in my department would be ruled out of time because, you know, the COVID year, 2020, and the whole stuff I learned, you know, from the lawyer's point of view about continuous behavior and stuff like that. So I kind of thought, well, it would be really good to get the ruling, but I don't know if it will just be ruled out of time. I thought we would win on the open letters because, you know, even by the OU's own training that they had by an external lawyer shortly after we set up the OUGCRN, they used the example of calls for boycott and social media pylons. So, you know, it seemed to me that we would probably win that.
These were open letters that your colleagues were signing, attacking you and encouraging other people to sign.
Yeah, let me just say 368.
Yeah, very collegiate, very collegiate approach.
Yeah, I didn't think we'd win on constructive dismissal. I didn't think we'd win on victimization. All that stuff, I kind of hoped we would, but I was worried that the panel would always do the same thing that everyone else does, and that's like, oh, it's a really difficult line between academic freedom and bullying.
I think the courts are distinguishing themselves in these cases, from Forstata right the way down through a number of other cases to you. I think the courts are getting it right, and I think it's an impressive story. Actually, they're confronting this stuff, and by and large, the judgments have been outstanding. Can I just finish by asking you? I mean, I think you're reasonably happy at Reading, as you said, but where do we go from here? How do we find a way through this? How do we combat this? How do we get people to understand that the approach which is being adopted by the University of Reading is the approach that should be adopted by all universities to confront this sort of stuff and to uphold free speech?
I think it's a two-pronged attack. I think that we need to reward good behavior, but we also need to punish bad behavior. And of course, I'm going to say that as a criminologist. But, you know, it came as an absolute shock to me, an absolute shock, that after the judgment, the compensation that I get is to compensate, you know, if we go through remedies, et cetera, is to just compensate me. But the court can't do a thing about the OU. So it would be perfectly possible for the OU just to carry on as they were.
But also these people, I mean, the whoever it was who did that, created that drawing, the gun attacking you, the young men in black masks demonstrating against Kathleen Stock at Sussex. There's no downside for any of these people. None of these people are ever sought. None of them are ever found. None of them are ever disciplined. No. There's no downside.
I mean,
it's,
you know, it came
way
out even in my, you know, so I had the whole experience at Essex. I was shocked and appalled by the fact that the registrar from Essex told me when the Rheindorf report came out that the poster was done too long ago, so they couldn't actually figure out who it was, that they weren't going to take any action. And then, you know, when I get to the OU in the summer of 2021, you know, I'd had a death threat. And yet the OU, you know, in the hearing, we heard from the head of HR that she had never read my grievance. So she hadn't been aware that I had received a death threat. And, you know, just that cavalier, and it is, it's a cavalier approach to what is violence, or the threat of it by a university.
Certainly the threat of violence, yeah. Joe, it really has been an enormous pleasure talking to you about all this. And I must say, I do think that you've borne all of this with extraordinary fortitude and courage. And there is an army of people out there who admire you for what you stand for.
Thank you.
For what you've achieved and for getting through this. And we, and I know Tim will join me in this, we wish you all the very best at Reading. I think the work you're doing is extraordinarily valuable. Not just your scholarly work, but also your campaigning work. So thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, no, you're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks very much, Joe. You've been listening to Double Jeopardy. This is episode 50, with hopefully many more to come. If you've enjoyed this episode, have a look at our back catalogue. There's plenty of interesting episodes to get through, many of them not time sensitive. So the fact that you're looking back at one a year ago shouldn't make any difference to your enjoyment. Our editor is Billy Lawrence. Our social media advisor is Jess Jones. And we will see you very soon.